this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
What just happened is devastating because you have 70 and 80 year old people who've been living there for 70 years since they were born, and it's all gone. Like 90% of the homes that burned up were black owned.
We'll hear from a homeowner whose house survived the Eaton fire that viciously burned Altadena and Pasadena's black neighborhoods, among other communities.
Everyone benefits from immigrant rights organizing. Everyone benefits from the organizing that immigrants lead and take on in terms of like advocacy, policy.
Immigrant workers in Pasadena, California, work to recover from the devastating fires and organize to face the threats from the incoming Trump administration.
Billions of people must be celebrating today, and especially indigenous people around the world who have, you know, many political prisoners.
Outgoing President Biden commuted Leonard Peltier's life sentence, moving him to house arrest, but declined to grant the indigenous political prisoner a full pardon despite appeals from supporters.
As the mom says himself, he said, make noise, just make noise, keep banging, keep making noise.
And we hear about the case of political prisoner Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly known as H-Rap Brown, his legendary history in the movement, his declining medical condition, the state of his freedom campaign, and what people can do to help him. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Dennis Haywood is the publisher of the Pasadena Black Pages and organizer and founder of the Black August Film Festival, as well as a homeowner whose house survived the Eaton fire that viciously burned Altadena and Pasadena's black neighborhoods, among other communities. Altadena Meadows was originally the land of Owen Brown, the son of abolitionist John Brown, after he fled the raid on Harper's Ferry and escaped, moving to Southern California in the 1880s. Here's Dennis Haywood in conversation with J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio.
How you doing, Mr. Dennis Haywood?
I'm doing as good as you could be doing under these circumstances, man.
So it's been, what, about 2 weeks since the fires in Altadena started. Can you talk a little bit about the history of Altadena and Pasadena and what life was like growing up in that area of Los Angeles, or I should say Southern California?
Growing up in Altadena, I grew up in Altadena. It was a black community. Like in the middle to the west side of Altadena, it was probably at one time 60 or 70% black in that area, right? And we're talking about thousands of homes. So it's a unique community in the fact that to this day, people say, well, we didn't even know black people lived out there, but it's a black community, though, Altadena.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationships between the people? Can you talk a little bit about home ownership in the black community? You know, give us a little bit more history of Altadena.
Okay, so Miss Harris, Corey Harris, she sold the first black people a house in Altadena in the 1950s. I think she told me it was 1953. And it was a white flight. So it was all white. It was an all white community until they sold black people a house, and then all the white people moved from West Altadena and Central Altadena, and black people just started buying homes because it was kind of redlined. They couldn't buy homes in Pasadena, really. So black people bought homes in Altadena, and that's how the community created. So by the 70s, it was just vibrant with black families and home ownership and the parks, the Little Leagues, everything was like 70-80% black. And it's crazy growing up in a community like that because it wasn't a poor community. It was an affluent community. So what just happened is devastating because you have 70 and 80 year old people who've been living there for 70 years since they were born, and it's all gone. Like 90% of the homes that burned up were black owned.
How many homes would you say burned up in that area?
The last I got from a really good source was 10,000 homes. blocks gone. You could see from one street to another that's a mile away. You know what I mean? And you could just see it. Everything is gone. It's the hardest thing to explain unless you got to be here to see it. It's just everything is gone.
Tell us, what was it like when you was pulling up your car to your neighborhood? What did you see? What was you feeling? And what happened? What was that first hour, those first few hours, that first night like?
Well, I got off the plane at LAX, and you couldn't smell the smoke, right, at LAX. So I got on the flyaway bus, and when I got to Union Station in downtown L.A., you could smell the smoke. And just knowing that it's coming from my neighborhood was, it was an unbelievable feeling. So the closer I got to Pasadena, the more you could smell the smoke. And by the time we got there, you could look at the sky, and it was just like, it was just red. The sky was red, and they had blocked off Altadena by this point on Wednesday night. But my best friend called me Tuesday night to tell me he was leaving because the power went out. The fire was nowhere near any of these homes on Tuesday night. But at like 2 o'clock in the morning, it hit, and by 4 o'clock in the morning, the whole community was gone. Like, that's how fast it spread. That's how hot the fire was. Everybody to tell the same story, like 3 o'clock, 3:30, their house was burning. And it just spread across the whole community.
I know that you've been there working in the community. What's going on? I mean, I know it's a major trauma for the whole community. How are y'all dealing with that? What is going on a day-to-day basis right now in Altadena? And are houses still burning?
No houses are burning anymore. It's not safe to go up there, but you can. If certain areas are open. We went to my friend's house yesterday for the first time and dug through some stuff. But the smell, like, you have to wear a mask. You really need a hazmat outfit suit to go and really dig through stuff because the smell is, I can't even explain the smell. It's just everything is burned up. So we went there yesterday, and I mean, it was emotional because he worked for that house, you know, and he grew up in Pasadena, and he bought a house in Altadena, and it's gone, you know. And he got his FEMA relief fund, which was only $60,000. So between insurance and FEMA, he's going to have to supplement that money to rebuild his home. And that's what everybody is going to be fighting against right now because they dropped a lot of people insurance like weeks before this happened, you know. So it's kind of like they knew something would happen. They knew something could happen because it hasn't rained down here in like 9 or 10 months at all, not a day. So everything was dry. This was like a perfect storm.
With you being a publisher and you being somebody that's very tuned into history, do you see a connection with the land grab that took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma over 100 years ago? And do you see a similarity with what is trying to be done in Altadena?
I would say that, yes, it's very similar in the fact that it's so many black homes, right? And now they're going to try to change Altadena because it's prime real estate. Like, it's 15 minutes away from the Burbank Airport and 15 minutes from downtown Los Angeles. It's prime real estate, and black people owned it. And it's no other place in Los Angeles like this. And now they are trying to get to people. It's vultures all around, ambulance chases. They're trying to get to people to offer them money for their land, you know, because it's in the hills. And people want that land. So the landscape is going to change, but we have a lot of groups going on right now to make it possible for black people to rebuild. If they don't rebuild, to resell to black people. Like, that's our mission. That's our goal right now. It's a lot of elderly people that don't want to go through the rebuilding process, so we're trying to make sure that they keep it in their family or they sell to black people.
What is going on at the different relief camps, and where are people staying right now in the Altadena, Pasadena area?
A lot of people are at the Civic Center, Pasadena Civic Center. People are at the Rose Bowl. A lot of people are in hotels. A lot of people sleeping on their family members' floors. I was working at one of the donation spots, and I asked people what they needed, and they said they needed everything. They lost everything. So it's Some people ask for air mattresses. Some people ask for pillows. Some people ask for blankets on top of the hygiene and stuff that was automatically given to them. But some people needed tents. Some people ask for tents. So it's a situation where, you know, some people have a house, right? And they own the house outright, but they don't have much money, you know? So now they're in a situation where they don't have money and they don't have a home. And the vouchers are running out for housing. Homeowners, renters are price gouging. They tried to go up on the prices, double up the prices because they knew people had to rent, you know? So now they got mandates saying you can't go up by 10% over what you was asking before. So it's a lot going on, man. It's a lot of homeless people, you know? It's a lot of crying and it's a lot of reflection because we were looking for my friend's black box yesterday. In the end, we found the contents of the black box that weren't perishable, but the black box didn't survive the fire. You know, he found keys and coins and things like that, but anything that was perishable, the fire took it down.
How has local, state, and federal government responded to y'all's situation? Are they coming up to the camps? What's going on? And do you feel like it's adequate?
Man, I feel like the community stepped up. I haven't been at any of those facilities with any government facility. The facilities I've been at, the places I've been were community-led, right? And it's amazing how many people just stepped up and start giving to people. As far as food, clothing, gift cards, so many food trucks and people who have stands, they posted up and was giving everybody free food. Like, the community really stepped up. The government has a command center at the Rose Bowl, and that's where all the firemen were stationed at. And the city of Pasadena stepped up because only 40 homes really burned in Pasadena. The rest of the homes were all in Altadena. So the city of Pasadena stepped up because Dena is, if you don't know, Pasadena and Altadena is really the same. It's no difference. It's just Alta is above Pasadena. But there isn't a high school in Altadena, so it's family. And the city stepped up. I don't have no complaints about the aid that has been given. All the insurance companies are posted up in different areas. And, you know, this hasn't happened before. So it's just, it's hard to deal with and it's hard to explain because so many lost so much. Everything. Like, since the power went out first, it was so dark up in Altadena because there's so many trees. It was so dark, people couldn't even see on their street. So they couldn't even go in their house to look for stuff because it was pitch black. It was pitch black when the lights went out, when the power went out. So a lot of people lost everything, like everything. Wedding rings, all kind of stuff. You know, it's just, I've heard so many stories that I haven't even been able to write about this, really, because every person in my family who lived in Altadena house burned. So every person in my family, we lost 9 houses in Altadena.
Your family lost 9 houses?
9 owned houses. All those houses were owned outright. It's a unique place. Altadena was a unique place. I say was because it ain't going to be the same. Like, the stores, everything burnt down.
What's your next move?
To help the people however we can. So I'm on an RV mission to help the people who are going to rebuild be able to live at their land or close to it when they're doing the rebuild and they'll have somewhere to stay. So that's my mission through my nonprofit is to get RVs for black people specifically.
What's the name of the organization and how can people tap in with you?
This is the Pasadena African American Film Foundation. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. You could go there, you could donate. That's our mission, is to get some RVs for some people. You know, if not, they don't donate, then we're trying to get a good price. And I want to get at least 10 of them, 10 RVs. Because we got to rebuild, and the only way we're going to rebuild is if we help those people. And I appreciate you and Pastor Leon for bringing the truck down to help us out. We taking all donations. It's going to take a village, and the village is going to have to be the whole state this time.
That was Dennis Haywood, publisher of the Pasadena Black Pages and founding director of the Black August Film Festival, speaking to J.R. Valray.
Welcome to pilgrims and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the city that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed, sent away. Yeah, but the people know it's winter.
That was Gil Scott-Heron, Winter in America. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Immigrant workers are being attacked by President Trump, who has promised to carry out massive terror raids against them. Nancy Mesa is with the National Day Labor Organizing Network, Endelon. She's based in Pasadena, California, and talks about the efforts of these workers in helping to recover from the catastrophic fires. She spoke to Peter Ross of KPFK and Workweek.
Endelon, we have a worker center in Pasadena, but also our national headquarters is based in Pasadena. So we're very connected to the Altadena, Pasadena community. So day one, you know, as soon as the fire struck in Altadena, the workers gathered and created these brigades, these fire brigades. Day one, it was just, you know, the day laborers from the office and their networks. And these, what these brigades did is that they went out into the affected areas and started cleaning up the debris. One, because we know that if we wait for the government to do it, it's just not going to get done. And two, because day laborers are trained. So a lot of the folks that come to the center have worked in other relief efforts, right? For example, in Katrina and Harvey. So they have the literal training of working in a post-disaster zone. After day one, we made the call out for volunteers. And ever since then, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers, both day laborers and just everyday folks from the Pasadena Altadena community, have been coming to the day labor center to take part in these brigades. And it's so beautiful to see, because it's immigrant workers leading with what they know best, with their skills, right? With their, like, labor, you know? Which for them is, like, a lot of pride. They take, like, a lot of pride in their labor. And just seeing them teach other folks, like, okay, this is how you work in a disaster zone, and seeing them take leadership has just been so amazing. But the goal of these brigades really is to start teaching folks how to self-organize, how to materially support the Altadena community, but also to show, right, in the face of Trump and all these anti-immigrant politicians, that immigrants aren't afraid, but also that we're stepping in to support our community before they do, right? And that we're doing it out of love, and that we're not going to stop doing it, right? The goal of all this relief effort really is for us to, you know, as immigrant communities, we're showing, this is how we show up to our community, right? This is how we show up for our community, and we're bringing folks along, right? We're bringing folks along. And if anyone has stopped by the Pasadena Workers Center, just know it's buzzing, right? It's just hundreds of people. Like, one corner is folks are, you know, going through distribution and donations. But really, the fire brigade is, like, the heart and soul of the operation, right? It's folks volunteering their time, their labor, and their, like I said, their expertise to clean up the neighborhoods. And they're going to continue doing it. This is the third week, right? So we started on day one of the fires, and we're entering week three. And I see no sign of them stopping. And it's right, it's also our way of showing up to our community with solidarity. After the fire, we saw there was some government agencies that passed out, for example, water, and that's it. We knew that was not gonna be enough. We knew that we needed to gather food and other resources. So it's kind of a way of us showing how you actually show up for a community, right? You don't show up and give them, like, the bare minimum, you give them the most that you can, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing to see that. I mean, this is really the most organized relief effort that's happening. And, you know, while the government is not funding the fire department or anything, the day laborers are really the ones stepping up to, that's amazing to see.
Yes, and it's 100% immigrant worker-led, which I think is so beautiful, right? And, you know, also just like day laborers on their own, right, as workers are seen as criminals, right? They're criminalized often, right? These are folks, individuals who, for example, if you're at a Home Depot and you see folks in the parking lot, right? These are folks who are there looking for work, right? They go out to look for work every day, right? So they're day workers. And just kind of to see them so empowered and in their power has been amazing. And I've been saying this loud and proud everywhere I go is that everyone benefits from immigrant rights organizing. Everyone benefits from the organizing that immigrants lead and take on in terms of like advocacy, policy, and workers' rights. Like we all benefit. And I think we all have a lot to learn from immigrant work, especially like the folks at Endelon, like who I said, like have been fighting this fight for the last 20 years. You know, Endelon, we are a national organization. We are a coalition of various day labor centers, not just here in California, but for example, across the country, New Jersey, New York as well. And a lot of the folks that are the leadership within the worker centers have been doing organizing for a long time or did organizing in their home countries. Right. So they are, yes, they see themselves as workers, but they also see themselves as forces of power. At Endelon, we also center a lot of our work in popular education. We use the opportunity of the worker centers to really politicize the day laborers. Right. So they understand, like, why are people demonizing us? Right. We do this through popular education, right, through visuals, very accessible education. So I would say we seem probably seem more militant because we're putting in the work to really break things down for everyday folks, right, so they could understand like the systems that are at play, what's affecting them, but most importantly, how they could fight back. I think that we have a lot of power. You know, as Endelon, we've engaged in campaigns to challenge ICE and we won, right? So we have power and we have tactics. And I think that's what immigrant workers bring, right? That experience of having had a bad boss that they have to, like, you know, for example, wage theft is a huge issue for the day labor community. That means you go out, you do a gig and you don't get paid. About every single day laborer has that experience. And they also have their experience of creating campaigns to get their money, right? Whether it be like finding legal action against a worker, you know, as like a peaceful way, or going to their house and having a serenade and having a march and demanding and letting all his neighbors know that he doesn't pay, right? That he's a bad employer. So, you know, that's the experience that immigrants workers bring to like the political field, right? And that's why I feel like it's just a disservice that unions aren't kind of honing in on this power. I think, you know, like for example, like Justice for Janitors, you know, there are a couple unions who do embrace immigrant workers, but unions have a lot to gain by embracing immigrant workers, more than they have to lose. One of our organizing strategies as Endelon is to create these just large popular assemblies where we bring folks together. And we did those in the Trump 1.0, right? This is a strategy that we took the first time Trump was in office that was very effective. And it's, you know, right now we know folks are doom scrolling, right? There's a lot of misinformation. So there is actually a lot of power, or we found that there's a lot of power in bringing people together in person, right? Bringing people together in mass. So these popular assemblies, you know, are going to be taking place, one in LA here early February. They're going to have, you know Your Rights workshops, but we're also going to share, you know, our organizing strategy, how folks could actually build out these different comités populares or popular defense committees to kind of learn the tactics that we've been studying, right, these past 20 years of how to, you know, fight back against ICE, how to stop deportations. And the goal is that these comités are then, you know, deployed throughout the United States, right? But it's organizing in your neighborhood where you're at, where you're from, with what you have, right? So it's connecting people who might not know what to do, but might want to take action, and giving them the tools to do so. And the good thing is there's already committees formed, and we just need, for example, like LA just needs to get it together and form our own, right? But a lot of this has been just resurfacing and kind of rekindling networks of solidarity that we've been building the past 20 years, yeah. So generally our Asambleas Populares are open to anyone who's down. Right, like if you want to come and support immigrants, you are welcome. I'm not sure what the union participation has been. I think it depends, like local by local, or like connection or individual connection by connection. But I would encourage like folks, if you're a union leader, to come. Right, so you can learn and see the tactics that immigrant workers are using and how we're organizing. Because I do think there's a lot to gain by even just observing, you know. But like I said, you know, as we're not going to wait for someone to come save us, right? We're not going to wait for the big unions to embrace the immigrant workforce. We're going to build our own power. We're going to build our own power as Endelon, as our own immigrant worker power. And then we could go from there.
That was day labor immigrant organizer Nancy Mesa with the National Day Labor Organizing Network speaking to KPFK and Workweek's Peter Ross. That was Los Jornaleros del Norte, La Cumbia Jornalera. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. As one of his last acts in office, outgoing President Joe Biden commuted Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier's life sentences to home confinement after nearly 50 years in prison. The decision follows decades of calls for clemency, citing concerns over due process, arbitrary detention, and Peltier's health. Despite pleas from supporters, the White House refused to issue a full pardon. Bill Means is the co-founder of AIM, the American Indian Movement, and the International Indian Treaty Council. Lenny Foster is also with the International Indian Treaty Council, and both are longtime friends of Leonard Peltier. Here are Bill Means and Lenny Foster in conversation with host of Flashpoints on KPFA, Dennis Bernstein.
Oh, man, what a day. I was like you, Dennis. I was so elated. I kept calling people. Can you assure me, is this true this time? Is this true? Because there was rumor after rumor about, I don't know, every time there's a change in the president, he was up for some type of parole reduction, amnesty. We even got to the point where we said, just releasing him on humanitarian issues. Because he's getting up there in age, and he had very many different health problems. And so we've been through the mill. I haven't seen him yet, but to hear that he was getting out, and they told us it was official, it was published in the White House schedule, and all this stuff that made it sound believable. I had to take a breath, think about it, all the thousands and millions of people around. Actually, millions. I remember there was one time, I believe it was 15 million signatures from Russia and Soviet Union one time that called for his release. Millions of people must be celebrating today, and especially indigenous people around the world who have, you know, many political prisoners throughout wherever there's resistance, wherever there's human rights violations, there's somebody that's standing up and boy, we feel so good. And I think of his children that have never seen him, you know, maybe heard his voice. They wonder what he looked like. Think about all the rallies we went to. My wife said she feels like crying. She herself been in so many rallies, powwows, fundraisers.
How many prayers on Alcatraz?
Some of the most sacred places in the world. We've had strong prayers. So I think, you know, they always said, anything gets him out of there, it'll be prayers and ceremony. And so that's where Lenny came in. So maybe I'll hand it over to Lenny a little bit, because he was a spiritual advisor for many years to Peltier. So maybe Lenny should give a little perspective. Hope.
Witness Leonard Peltier being granted clemency. And we all feel happy, sad at the same time. Very joyous occasion to see that and witness that in our lifetime. 50 years is a long time. You know, I met Leonard in Denver, Colorado in 1970, in the fall of 1970. And we became friends. We were both young, idealistic, joined AIM, American Indian Movement, under the leadership of the late Vernon Balcourt. I participated in some demonstrations, Cass Lake, Leech Lake, Minnesota, where the American Indian Movement was asked to come and set up roadblocks because the white sportsmen from the Minneapolis, St. Paul area were coming onto the reservation, poaching the animals, the deer, the elk, fishing out of season without any permit. No license, and the tribal council asked Dennis Banks, the American Indian Movement, to come in and set up roadblocks. And that's where I became more acquainted with Leonard Peltier, because he was one of the main security chiefs under Dennis Banks. So I became even more acquainted with him. August of 1975, I Sundanced with him at Crow Dog's Paradise, one of the original first Sundances. It was right there on his homeland. First and only time, actually. Five, Sundance with AIM. It was Russell Means, Dennis Banks, Bill Means, Ted Means, Archie Fire, Fool's Crow, people like that. And Leonard Peltier, he Sundance, and I remember he pierced the first round. That's very unusual, not usually done, because the people started piercing the third day and dancing for 3 days prior to that, pierce and then break. I started visiting him in the federal prison in 1985. Started doing the sweat lodge ceremonies, the pipe ceremonies, the spiritual counseling for the Indian boys. And I did that for 37 years. I visited him right there in Leavenworth, Kansas. Then they transferred him in 2005 to Lewisburg, another maximum security prison. Then they transferred him to, in 2015, they transferred him to USP Coleman. That's where he's at right now. 1985, when they started the sweat lodge ceremonies at Leavenworth. And through the years, I feel like I've done 50 years with him. And I'm very glad. I feel very happy that our prayers were answered. You know, the sweat lodge ceremony is an ancient ceremonial practice of the Lakota and other Plains Indians people. The Sundance is not part of our Dene traditional beliefs, but I participated and I Sundanced for 26 years. And all that time I was able to visit with Leonard Peltier. And he was a good Sundance or sweat lodge person. He really enjoys doing the sweat lodge. Of course, we were all young. We could endure the hot grandfather's breath, they call it. He learned the songs. He learned to pray and the language. Sweat Lodge was a movement itself. It grew throughout the whole prison system. Still exists today. And he always fought for that. When he gets out, he needs to do a cleansing and a purification to cleanse himself before he goes back into his new home. He's a boarding school survivor. And I believe the NDN Collective are going to be helping him.
We just heard from Lenny Foster and Bill Means speaking with host of Flashpoints Dennis Bernstein on the release of Indigenous political prisoner Leonard Peltier. We thank KPFT's Jacqueline Batiste for the production of this segment. AIM song, Free Leonard Peltier. Next, we hear a commentary by U.S. political prisoner and prolific journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, recorded by Prison Radio.
Leonard leaves prison. Just a few hours ago, Leonard Peltier left the U.S. prison cell, what Indigenous people call the Iron House, and began the long trek home to North Dakota, where he was busted in 1975. His release by executive clemency, issued by U.S. President Biden, came the same day as some 900 Palestinians were released in Israel, mostly women and juveniles. They were held in detention in Israel. Among them, Khalida Jarar, two indigenous freedom fighters, released a world apart on Martin Luther King's Day. For almost 55 years, Leonard Peltier has been in the Iron House. From 1975 to January 2025, where he now suffers from diabetes, numbness in his hands and feet, and near blindness after a trial that officials at the United Nations call in violation of international law. Today, Leonard Peltier goes home. Today, indigenous people across Turtle Island or America walk a little straighter. Today, a victory in a long, long war is won. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you, me and my people just about do. I've been there so I know, keep on saying go slow. Well, that's just the trouble, washing the windows, picking the cotton, you're just plain rotten. You thought I was kidding, didn't you? Picket lines, school boycotts, they try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. Yes, you lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. Oh, but this whole country is full of lies. You all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust you anymore. You keep on saying go slow. Go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Desegregation, mass participation, unification. Do things gradually, but bring more tragedy. Why don't you see it? Why don't you feel it? I don't know, I don't know. You don't have to live next to me.
That was Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasiliev. With the recent granting of clemency to Native political prisoner Leonard Peltier, Block Report's J.R. Valray talked with Imam Lukman about the case of political prisoner Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly known as H.Rab Brown. They talked about Imam Jamil's legendary history in the movement, his declining medical condition, the state of his freedom campaign, and what people can do to help him.
Great to be on the show. If I may I open with, I seek refuge in Allah from misleading and being misled, from betraying and from being betrayed into ignorance by others. I ask Allah to guide my heart and to guide my tongue. This reference is the opening that Imam Jamil always leads in any of his speeches or conversations.
Yes, sir. Can you tell the people a little bit about who was Imam Jamil Al-Amin before he became a political prisoner and what led to his political imprisonment?
But prior to him taking Shahada and becoming Imam Jamil Al-Amin, he was Herbert Gerald Brown, born October 4th, 1943. The most people back in the Black Panther, 60s, 70s revolutionary era knows him as H.Rab Brown. He was a astounding student of human rights and in the way he was brought up. A founding civil rights leader. From there, he followed his brother, Herbert Brown, to Howard University, where he got involved with student activities and the organizations going on there, where he met fellow members of the SNCC organizations, which he got involved with. He was the fifth chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. He preceded Stokely Carmichael. He was a Black Panther Minister of Justice for 6 months during the alliance between SNCC and the Black Panther Party. He was, in my opinion, one of the most astute and revolutionary and founding, forwarding people that you compare and put in the same class as Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, who could galvanize and move people with his speech and his vision. In Maryland, and I'm not sure about the town there, there was a meeting going on there. And during this meeting, he spoke. Prior to that, he was leaving with a sister who asked it to be escorted. And then someone fired from a bushes and he was grazed. After that, there was a riot that took place, which was attributed to him, which he really didn't have anything to do with.
What year are we talking about?
Late 60s. They passed the Rap Brown Act, which actually stated that you couldn't cross state lines in the means of trying to incite violence or riots. So he ended up having a whole law passed in his name based on something that he had nothing to do.
Congressional law at that.
Yeah. One thing he did do that a lot of people don't understand, he brought a lot of the gangs and the inner community together. He stopped a lot of the fighting, and not only just between the Black gangs, but I'm talking about, you know, the whites, so-called neo-Nazis and all these other type of groups who actually, you know, when he spoke, paid attention to them. It's not too many people you can actually think of or count on your hand can actually go into a group of neo-Nazis and hold a conversation and come out of the conversation with them asking how can they help you or whatever else, you know, you think we need we to do. So he ends up with them, you know, coming out of their set as far as being racist and violent and destructive things that they were doing in communities as far as the gangs. And all of a sudden now he's got everybody working together and trying to uplift the community, and also give direction to the youth.
So what is his case about? When was he arrested, and what is the case about?
If we go back to May 31st, 1999, he was driving from Whitehall, Alabama, and he was stopped over in Meredith, Georgia, by Officer Johnny Mack for suspicion of a stolen vehicle. Upon a search, they found a bill of sale on him and also a police badge, which he explained was a gift that was honorarily given to him by Mayor John Jackson of Whitehall. They arrested him and charged him, and even though he had proof that the car was his, it was proven that the mayor had given him the badge, they still charged him with speeding, auto theft, and impersonating an officer. This led up to March 16th of 2000, where two officers, Ricky Kitchen and Aldrin English, were on a run, actually, to go to Imam Jamil's house of residence. At this time, he was in Georgia at the West End, where he had his home, masjid, and a store. And they were going to pick him up on failure to appear in court on the speeding, auto theft, and the impersonating officer charge. When they got to his facility, they found out, okay, he wasn't home. So they got in the car and had turned around and was leaving. But just as they was leaving, they saw a black Mercedes come down and head towards the mom's house. So they proceeded to turn around and they put their car up against the other car. It was a gentleman in the car that got out to ask him, okay, show me your hands. And it was said that he said, okay, you want me to show you my hands? And he turned and fired on the officers. The thing about this was the fact that the mom wasn't even home. He was on his way to Whitehall at that time. This individual, the police said, was the same size and build as an imam. He was wearing a long trench, a black trench. There's knowledge among some people and some things that people won't talk about, but there was an individual also in the West End who had an identical black Mercedes, was the same height as the imam, and, you know, because he always wore the same things that the imam wore. And they, you know, got to a point where they said, okay, you know, they started calling them twins. But anyway, in the shootout, one of the officers was shot. The other one fired a shot and said he hit the individual in the shoulder and actually stated that he had gray eyes. Now, Imam Jamil doesn't have gray eyes whatsoever. They said the car sped off and they picked up Imam Jamil in Whitehall and said that in the report that the car had been shot up. There were no bullet holes in the car. They said they shot the individual in the shoulder. Imam Jamil had not been shot, nor did he have any weapons or any powder residue on his hand. Now, there was a particular FBI agent who had a bone to pick about the imam for years and years, who actually came down and was on the scene. He wasn't even on the case. But anyway, just mysteriously, he had the guns and produced a bullet casing that he said was on the windshield at the wiper blades of the imam's car. Now, you imagine traveling from Georgia to Alabama with a lead casing sitting on your car, which is light. And in all this wind, this thing is actually still going to be there. And that just by chance, you know, this officer, you know, he just happens to find it.
Hmm.
Then, right after his arrest, the weird thing about it in the community, some of the neighbors and elders, there's a warehouse located in the area, they said that they saw an individual limping, running from the scene. There was a blood trail. They said he was knocking on individual's door, trying to get help. In the report, when I had inquired whether or not at this point in time, if the police still had the blood evidence, if we could check it again, and come to find out, when I talked to Kyrie, he said he was told that it was dog's blood. And my thing is, okay, where's the dog coming from, you know? So then you got this one individual that's making phone calls right after this to the FBI, all the way up to the top of the chain, stating that he did the shooting. Matter of fact, he admitted to his probation officer at the time that he was the one that did the shooting. Matter of fact, he gave so much details. All the information that he gave, no one would know any of that in so much detail unless you had been there personally.
Okay.
And he had been shot.
Okay.
So after that, the mom was taken to Montgomery, Alabama, and for a month he was fighting extradition back to Georgia. He was detained in the Montgomery Detention Center. On March 17, 2000, this individual I'm talking about, Otis Jackson, a.k.a. James Santos, told his parole officer, Sarah Bacon, that he shot the officer. April 21st, 2000, the imam was moved to Georgia to Cobb County Adult Detention Center.
Where does the case stand now?
Okay, right now the case stands, it's basically like in limbo. When I talked to the lead attorney for the Innocence Project, she had received about 3,000 pages of information from Sister Karima. It was so redacted, she said it was worthless. So right now, even with this man's testament, you know, statement, and he made it to the FBI and in court several times that he was the shooter, there's nothing they can do. They can't proceed on anything, which doesn't make sense.
You're talking about the government can't proceed on anything?
She's saying that they can't proceed on anything because they don't have enough evidence. And even with the brother's statement that he shot the officer, they can't go with that either.
How is the imam doing? I understand that he has medical ailments at this time.
Yeah, I spoke to him on the 4th. At that time, depending on what's going on, they're allowed 10-minute calls, 5-minute calls, depending on what's going on. At this time, we talked for less than 2 minutes because there's a picture circulating. And if you see it, he has a big, like almost like a grapefruit-sized ball on the left side of his jaw. It hurts for him to speak. It's interfering with his eyesight. And he can't eat. He's on a liquid diet right now. The only thing he can eat it would be like oodles of noodles and basically Ensure. The administration is not doing anything as far as trying to help him with that. And at his age at 81, I mean, this is one of several health conditions that he's had. I mean, he's already had a stroke back in 2018. He had cataracts in 2019. And through consistent protesting from various groups and the public, he was transferred to Butner Medical Facility in North Carolina for cataract surgery. But through all these incidents, you know, there's nothing done at the facilities. Right now, with this thing on his face, he has the medical facilities and some of the workers at the prison worried because they came to the warden and they're in fear. What we're going to do, you know, because the prison is in uproar. The inmates had enough. They are protesting the fact that there's nothing being done for this brother. Right now, he's in a walker. And that's mostly due to the fact that over the years, like I said, he had a stroke and he also has smoldering melanoma, which is blood disease of the bone.
So what is it that people could do that are listening to this broadcast?
What people can do is get on the phone, one, and make phone calls to the Tucson, Arizona prison at 520-663-5000, prompt one. Give the imam's inmate number, which is 999-74555, and ask that he be sent to Butner or for medical help, and also ask why is he not receiving any attention. And if we can get a constant succession of phone calls and actually tie that line down and also get on the warden's nerve enough, possibly we can get something done, because that's what took place when he had the cataracts, what we had to do. We just constantly had to make phone calls, be pestering. And as the imam says himself, he said, make noise. Just make noise. Keep banging. Keep making noise. Call your congressperson if you can. Write to whoever. I mean, I even wrote a letter prior to the United Nations Board of Prisons.
Thank you for your time, Imam Lukman. We're going to push our people to support Imam Jamil Alameen, and can you give that phone number one more time as well as his inmate number?
It's 520-663-5000, prompt one when it's answered. His inmate number is 999-74555. They can contact IJAM, Imam Jamil Action Network.org, or they can call myself at 919-628-9146.
All right, I want to thank you for your time, Imam Lukman.
Appreciate it.
That was Imam Lukman speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. To hear more from J.R., visit blockreportradioworld.com. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, J.R. Valray, Peter Ross, and Jacqueline Batiste. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.